Hello, it's Antrice, and welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast. Billy O. O'Donnell is my guest today. Billy O. has an interesting story. Like so many artists, he struggled with the decision to pursue art as a vocation. But standing in his boss's office at a Missouri sawmill, Billy O. came to a life-changing realization. And that realization was that there are no safe paths, so he may as well take his own chances. So Billy O. carved out his own path in the world of corporate illustration, negotiating a brilliant deal with his employer that got his paintings into corporate collections across the United States. And later on, after being rejected from multiple galleries in his home state, a painting trip to California inspired Billy O. to start his own painting ventures. We talk about the uncertainty and dedication in multi-year projects, how the National Endowment of the Arts contacted Billy O. and expanded on one of his projects, plus the book that followed, Painting Missouri. We also talk about the plein air events and what Billy O. looks for when judging painting competition and how he sees the art world changing in the next couple years. So without further ado, here is Billy O. O'Donnell. So hello, Billy O., and thank you so much for joining The Savvy Painter. I appreciate you spending the time with me.
Well, hi, Antrice. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
Can you tell me a little bit about when you first decided to become kind of a professional artist, when you decided that you were going to jump in on this and do it for real?
You know, it's probably that concept has probably come and went a couple of times. When I went to college, I actually went to art fairs during the summer and sold artwork. So I would make these wild sculptures and do drawings, and I just had it all. And I would do that. And, you know, ultimately we all want to go to college and become the, you know, a teaching professor at a university or something like that. But that was just out of the question. And I had just made my mind up probably when it hit me the most, it was when I actually went to college for a year and I flunked out, and I had two amazing instructors because I just had no one I could look at and say, I want to be like that artist.
Yes. No role models whatsoever. Nobody in your family or?
No, nobody at all. When I was in high school, I'll never forget, my dad went to get his name painted on the side of the truck, which was required by law with anyone that had a pickup truck. In Missouri, you had to have your name painted on the side of the truck. And I went with him, and I watched this guy letter on the side of this truck just by hand, and it just moved me tremendously. And then I went to – so I just had no one. I went to college. I just thought it was – everybody was – all my family members told me I was going to starve to death. And I never took it seriously. I went to college, and I had a great time. And these two instructors I had, they said – I remember their names to this day, Larry Pogue and Chuck Shoemakers. They said – you know, you're one of the most talented students we ever had. You can sit out for a year, get your head together, come back, and we'll teach you art. And I sat out for that year, and I just, it was during the 1975 recession. I graduated high school in 74, and there was no work anywhere. And I worked in an iron foundry that was, that every other employee was an ex-con, and and then I wound up getting a job in a sawmill. Mm-hmm. I worked on a hog farm, and I worked on a sawmill. I just went through a series of really bad jobs. And I was working at the sawmill, and I had an accident where a saw blade, it's about 15 inches in diameter, and it went way up on an arm and would pivot out. It caught on some blocks of wood and kicked out, and it went up kind of the side of my hand. And
oh, my gosh.
Well, it just cut my thumb, the back of my thumb, or the top of my thumb, on the very back of it, and it cut that ligament. And so I go up, and I'm in the office. I had to walk like about 100 yards, and I was standing there, and I'll never forget the guy's name to this day, Marion Ornby. He was looking at me, and Marion was, you know, and I still had the goggles on and the ear things for the sound, and I was standing there, and I lost a lot of blood already, but I was standing there looking at him, and he was a good, honest, hardworking man. And the guy had worked his whole life, and the guy had nothing. You know, you're still raised a family, and he had nothing. And that was my biggest fear about becoming an artist, was just not having any money, being broke, being poor, being having nothing. Mm-hmm. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. I saw a lot of him and me, or me and him, and I, that's when I decided I was going back to college, and I never looked back. And I pursued art with just a passion, and I've never looked back.
Well, so you're standing there, I'm assuming, like holding your thumb and like,
yeah, holding my thumb squeezing it. So it's, and you know, and they're actually, I mean, there was blood running out the door, and I remember he drove me over to the hospital in Herman, Missouri. And you know, he had to hold me up cause I couldn't sit up. And, you know, while he was driving, and it just, but that moment, I had this spiritual moment,
Was it kind of like, you know, okay, here's a guy who's worked in the sawmill his entire life and he still has nothing, so I should, you know, I might as well do it anyway? Or how did that kind of move you to, I'm going to dedicate myself to art?
I think you're right. I think you're exactly right, because the fear was, you know, I come from this Irish working class background, mm-hmm. you know. Take big steps. Always, you know, if you're not doing anything, pick up the broom, sweep the floor, you know. And I it's one of those kinds of families that, you know, that you work hard and you'll always do well, you know. And that was probably the biggest fear for me. And the other biggest fear was that I still knew no one. There was no one out there that was a full-time artist making a living. And so that moment just changed my whole life. That moment did. I didn't realize how much of an impact it had on me. And you know, I'll never forget students when I was going to college. That, you know, some of them were kind of like, you know, some of them were like, wow, I just love your passion, how you're so passionate about this. And others, you know, they were just really perplexed by my drive and my sincerity of just trying to learn as much as I could.
Wow, that's a great story.
Well, thank you.
I mean, I'm sorry about your thumb, but
no one sees it unless I point it out. You know, you know. So I always have that ability to just look at my hand and remember that.
Wow, that experience must have just been like. It is a shock.
It is a shock. And I'll never forget, I was right there when Marion called my home to tell, you know, basically tell my mother. My dad happened to be there, and he gets, you know, and this is my dad for you, but he gets on the phone with my dad, and he goes, my dad's, yeah, hi, Marion. And right away, my mom knew something was wrong, because there's no reason why the sawmill.
Yeah.
Exactly. And whenever he said something, my dad would, you're down at the hospital with Billy. Yeah. You know,
and your mom's just standing there getting half the conversation.
Exactly. And so Mary goes, he cut his thumb. And he goes, you know, everything will be fine. They're taking good care of him. And, you know, he said he could hear my mom in the background say, what happened to Billy? And my dad says, hold on one second, Marion. It's Billy. He's down at the hospital. He cut his hand off. I know. But anyway, that's he was just, my dad was just a real character.
Sounds like it. So tell me a little bit about, okay, so you you decide to go to art school after that injury, and you're really intensely studying, and just sounds like you were just a sponge.
Yes, and I had no patience. I had no patience for teachers who were not willing to teach. And I had several of them down the college where I went. And I had some that, you know, that they would walk up and they'd say, well, you know, this painting has no weight. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by weight? You know, and they'd say, well, that's for you to figure out. You know, and I got so frustrated. And then I found some other instructors like Armstrong, who was willing to tell you everything and show you things and show you techniques and methods. And, you know, so I started gravitating more to the instructors that would tell you everything, share things with you, because I had met many artists in the past where you would ask them, say, they'd have a certain color and you ask them about that color, and they would try and do everything they could to not tell you even how they mix that color. And
that's so crazy to me. So why do you think that is?
You know, I don't know. I think it's just fear. You know, I think back then people, you know, if you had information, you guarded it. I don't know, but not everyone was like that, you mm-hmm. know? And I don't want to live a life like that of guarding information. I share it because it can maybe open up a whole new window for someone else, you know? But that's always been frustrating for me. There's always been people like that. I guess maybe they fear you're going to take their job. I don't know.
Yeah. Or it's insecurity. Like if I tell you exactly how I mixed that green, because of course that green is everything about my painting. I have no other talent than mixing that green.
Or maybe it's just the power of holding something over you. I don't
know. Who knows?
Know.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I never tried to figure it out. I just moved on to people who would enrich me.
What did you do after college? Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, how you made the transition from a student to a working artist?
Well, when I got out of college, there again, it was a bad time to get out. It was 1980, major, major recession. Again, there was the high inflation. I don't know if you remember that. You might be too young, but the inflation rates got up to 20%, and there was no work anywhere. It was just horrible. So I graduated with my degree in sculpture because I was so frustrated with the painting department. And I went on to come up to St. Louis and work for my aunt doing floral arrangements because there was no work anywhere. And the only work I could really find, you know, I just didn't have enough money to get back into the street shows and do those. And the street shows, the art fairs, they kind of bothered me because once you do those for a while, you start to become so slick and commercial. And I was seeing it with a lot of artists. Everything would become packaged in terms of the art and everything. And I'm not saying everybody's like that. I'm just saying some of the artists I saw that I admired their work, they became very commercial in the way that they created things and sold things. So I got a little bit frustrated. And at that time, it seemed like the only, you know, and I'd approached galleries here in St. Louis with my landscapes and drawings. And they usually only asked me two questions. They asked me, you know, where are you from? Or they asked, what do you do? And I'd say, well, I'm from here or St. Louis. Or if I said I'm a landscape painter, right away they would just say, no, thanks. Because St. Louis was really had a focus more on the East Coast, you know, more of a New York artist and out in California and in L.A. or San Francisco. So there just was no place I could even go to show my work.
So they didn't even want to look at your work.
They had no interest in even looking at it, yes. And I got shut out by many, many galleries like that. And at that time, the galleries were the gatekeepers. They were the gatekeepers to the people that could sell the art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that bought the art. So then I realized that that wasn't going to change. And so I had to decide what to do. And that's when I decided the only place that you could make a living doing your art and they appreciated your ability was illustration.
Mm.
And I wound up getting a job. I applied for an illustrator's position at Meritz. I told you about that earlier. Meritz was the third largest art department in America. And there was Disney, Hallmark Cards, and then Meritz Motivation. They had 25 full-time painters. And at the time, they were expanding. They were bringing in artists from New York, Florida, and I believe out west. And I got into Meritz, and I just flourished. I just did really well. You know, they would come to you with an art catalog, and they'd say, order what you need. And
what a dream come true.
My gosh. You know, I can't tell you how many brushes I ordered, and I would fill like office drawer. I remember I filled an office drawer with brushes. Imagine a filing cabinet drawer filled up, you know, almost to the top where I put cardboard on the sides of it. And I just filled it up with brushes, different kinds of brushes, different kinds of, and I could order paints and I could order all the paint I wanted. And I turn in and I go, is this too much? And I'm like, no, this isn't too much. And I ordered paints, and it was just a wonderful place to work as an artist. You know, a lot of times when I say I was an illustrator, but when you looked at what an illustrator did at this motivation company, it was not like, you know, you were like under the thumb, because these things were very creative in creating motivational programs for these employees, these companies. Mm-hmm. And it was just a lot of fun. You know, we'd look at the demographics of each company and who we were trying to motivate and what we were doing. And we'd come up with these, you know, if it was a younger group, we'd come up with something funky and fun. Or if it was an older group, we would do these things. And then I started winning awards in LA for my illustration work, and in New York. And actually the New York Society actually waived their portfolio review and invited me to be a member. So I became a member of the Society of Illustrators in New York, which to me meant so much because I just love so many of the old illustrators from years ago.
Yeah.
And then I won a big award in Japan, where they actually they invited artists from around the world, and this book sold in every country in the world, and they put my artwork on the cover of the book. And then my Missouri landscapes were the first four pages in the book. And
oh, nice.
I know. It was. And so I did a pitch to the salesman at Meritz. I said, look, you know, the Japanese love my work. What do you say next time there's a corporate event, you know, you maybe have me come in and do some little plein air studies, and then I would do a big painting to commemorate the business event. So I started flying. They started flying me to places like Hawaii, you know, Laguna Niguel, and the Arizona Biltmore, and Mauna Lani. Just these amazing places. And I would do these paintings. I'd do a series of little landscapes, and they'd pick out which ones they wanted. And then I would convert that into a large painting in the lobby. And then the company would make prints for them. So it was.
Oh, wow. So you would. So were these like corporate events, corporate meetings, and then you would go out and do little landscape studies?
Yes. And then they would pick one, and then I would do a large painting of that one. And then that big painting would go into the corporation.
And then way to do it, Billy-O.
Well, you know, that was one of the things that I got to do a lot of when I worked at Meritz, was whenever they had these brainstorms of creating a unique program for one of these Fortune 500 corporations. You know, Meritz at the time was an $8 billion company back then. And so they would bring me up, and I learned to listen to ideas. I learned to listen to creative ideas, because when I was young, I had to become very stubborn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to, I think just to survive as an artist, because so many people would just think you were nuts for doing it. And I learned to listen to people, and I would learn to kind of help mold these things into these solid programs for these corporations. And then I'd go back downstairs and work my paintings, you know. And for me, it was really exciting because it really taught me a lot about just coming up with a solid idea.
Yeah.
And that stuff carried over into other things later on in life. And Meritz would actually send us to workshops. Like, they actually paid for me to go to a Richard Smith workshop, you know, and like that. And that's when I met, that's when I met an artist who had a tremendous impact on me, Dan Guzet, a California artist. I think he still does work for Disney. And I wound up going to the San Juan Capistrano Mission Paint Up back in 1996. And they would have 100 select artists from California and 5 guest artists from across the country. And I was fortunate enough to be one of those artists. And that event changed my life, because you bring in 100 artists on this little 4 acres of the San Juan.
It's tiny.
It was. You're exactly right. And so you would always be standing there next to another artist who would be painting. And you're like, oh, my gosh, you know, and that's when I met everybody. I met, you know, so many people, you know, Peter Adams, Alexei Steele, you know, George Strickland, John Budison. I mean, so many of these California painters that just became friends and became people that inspired me. You know, and that's one thing that when I talk about artists, you'll hear me talk more about my contemporaries, because one thing, I mean, a lot of people say, yeah, you know, this artist inspired me or this artist, but
yeah,
there's nobody that'll inspire you more than your contemporaries.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm just a believer in that. So I came back to St. Louis and I created the Forest Park Paintout. And then the Forest Park Paintout turned into, a few years down the road, turned into, I did it for a couple of years. And then I had a bigger vision of creating a bigger event that went across the whole state. And this is where, you know, that those concepts come in. And I created an event called the Artists Along the Katy Trail. And the Katy Trail is the longest rails to trails project in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's when we partnered, the St. Louis Artists Guild partnered with all these different art groups along the trail, because these art groups would give us instant access to their members, mm-hmm. their local media, and their sponsors. And so it was just this huge success. A writer came along named Karen Glines, who was the online arts editor for AOL, and she wound up leaving that job and she joined us on this trail. And I just had to, you know, explain to her, I said, we got no money. There's just no money. And so we were the people that were kind of running this whole troop. My other vision I had was that we would do a website that would daily log and have a sponsor's name under each daily log, pictures of artist's work, and talk about what the artist was doing in the painting. Mm-hmm. And so Karen started taking over some of that, and well, she interviewed probably 300 artists in the time that event went on. So these artists came from all across the country to paint in this.
How long was this event?
This event was four-day weekends, and we would stay in these. Each day we'd stay in a different little town along the Missouri River Valley. It was just a hoot, and some of these towns would give us like a historic house to go in, and we'd take our sleeping bags in there and sleep. Old historic homes, you know, and, you know, we'd sit there and drink wine, and Karen would be typing at the computer. You know, it was just an absolute blast. And then the National Endowment for the Arts got a hold of me and said, tell us about this event you put together. And I told them, and then the next year they implemented it in every state in the union under the Millennium Legacy Trail Fund.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That must have been such an honor for you.
Well, there was really no big credit or letter or anything, but that's where that idea came from. And it's,
So did that sort of start with that experience of painting at Mission San Juan Capistrano, where you're surrounded by 100 artists?
Yes.
At an event. So then you decided to go ahead and make your own.
Exactly. You're exactly right. I came back to St. Louis, and here I was. California appreciated my work so much that they invited me to California as a guest artist, and I got picked up by the premier gallery at the time, Joan Irvine Smith Fine Arts in Southern California, in Irvine, California. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they carried all the old great artists like Guy Rose and, you know, Hanson Puthoff, all the California Impressionists. And
wow.
And I come back to St. Louis and I couldn't get into a gallery to save my life. And that's when I said, you know, I'm going to create an event so that, for one thing, I'm not just a lone person here. In the region. I'll have friends and other, all these artist friends around me. And not only that, but these galleries will have to deal with hundreds of artists coming to them and work and saying, I'm a landscape painter. And because I did that event back in 96, I came back and did it was either 96 or 97, I started the Katy Trail event. I mean, I'm sorry, the Forest Park Paintout. That plein air events have, you know, just proliferated all through the Missouri region and out along that trail. And there's some places like the Augusta plein air event, you know, and things like that that have picked up after the 2 years of the Katy Trail event went through.
So after you created that, and then the NEA comes in and they kind of created their own version of that. So you got picked up by this gallery. Did that allow you to leave your job and start painting full time? Or once that happened, what did you do? Were you just like, oh my God, this is awesome?
Yes. No, you're exactly right. I thought it was awesome. So I left Merritt's in 96 and At the time, Meritz was a lot of companies started opening their own little motivation departments in the company, and they started having cutbacks. And so it was just a great time for me to go. I just went in and told management. I said, if you're going to let anybody go, let me go, because, I didn't want to walk away without getting a package.
I did that once too. That's so funny. There's so many parallels. It's so strange. Okay, go on.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of parallels with the same thing with Disney. It's one of those things where I went and told them, I said, don't feel bad if you let me go. You're going to let me go because I really want to pursue my painting. And so they let you go. And then all of a sudden you have this deep hole.
They let me go.
Whoa. Oh, man. And it was, and I went home. And my wife Peggy is wonderful. She supports me tremendously, and I cannot do an interview without mentioning my wife Peggy. But Peggy, I'll never forget when I told her. I said, Peggy, she's like, "Are you going to try and get another job?" And I said, Peggy, I'm not working for anyone else ever again but me.
Mm-hmm.
And a month later, after she stopped crying, she went and got a job. But it was hard. It was hard on all of us. And, I just have never been a big money-making artist. I've always been an artist that has just pursued my passion and where my art takes me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe I'd be better off if I just refined a particular craft of mine and just got well-known for that. But, I just want to be known as a painter, and I want my paintings to always keep growing and evolving.
But it sounds like, I don't know if I believe you, Billia. I'm not sure if I believe. I'm not buying this story. just because, from what you've told me about what you did at Merit and with acquiring that sort of, you kind of have invented your own little place in there of going to these corporate events and getting your work into their corporate collections. And then you go to California and you come back to Missouri and you create your own event. So
yes,
you got something going on there. you got more ambition than just kind of like, yeah, I just paint.
No, but you got to realize that when you look at those little presentation I made to the salespeople about doing that, or when I created the artist along the Katy Trail, that it was more about the concept and the idea. And that's the one thing I really pride myself on, is when you look at where my art is, a lot of times these concepts and these ideas or I create these things fall right in place with where my art is.
Yeah, it's interesting because it feels, like maybe at the time it feels like, well, I don't know, hindsight's always 20/20, right? So now looking back, you can see what was going to happen. But at the time, you had no idea what would happen if you organized these events and if anyone would come, or like if when you first had the idea.
Yes.
There's that kind of impulse to act on it. But at that moment, you don't know what's going to happen.
No, you're exactly right. And at the end of the last Katy Trail event, the writer who had interviewed all those hundreds of artists, Karen Lines, she approached me and said, why don't we do a book on Missouri? So the Katy Trail led to the concept of me creating a book where I painted in every county in the state of Missouri. And we are I think we're number five in the country with the most counties. And so I ensued 7 years of, just running around Missouri and painting landscapes, and there'll probably never really be a big financial payoff on that, but it was just another concept that just drew me in, and I still own the 115 paintings, and the book has been printed 3 times. It was first printed by the University of Missouri Press. It's been printed 3 times and sold out all 3 times. We're talking about reprinting it again. And I probably did 3 paintings in each county and just tried to get the right one for the book that worked the best. So again, I mean, there's another example of even how the whole Painting Missouri project, a lot of times all we need is usually right here in front of us, and we just need to find it, and that's kind of what my whole journey has been about, is just a lot of times these things come in front of me.
Well, there's resourcefulness, you know, there's being resourceful, and then there's just kind of sitting there hoping or waiting for things to just happen. You know, I mean, you've created your own opportunities when there was nobody willing to take your art in Missouri, whether you knew you were doing that at the time or not. You basically just said, all right, fine. Then I'm going to create my own stuff.
Exactly. And there was no big grant. There was no money up front, nothing, you know, and I didn't have money for hotels, and I would just camp out all the time in the middle of winter, and it was just something that was really good for me. As a matter of fact, the painting.
When you did that, did you know you were going to do a book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it was planned.
It was always going to be a book.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the whole concept, and even when we told the university what we were doing. Yeah, there was no book contract until I was probably about 5 years into the project.
So, God, we have so many parallels, because I did a painting project in Argentina that was I went to all the provinces in that country.
Oh my God!
And same thing, but I didn't do the book, so maybe I should do that. But
there you go. Exactly. Well, and that project was another way for me to connect to where I was raised. It was an mm-hmm. excuse for me to drive down a road and explore it, or to go see something and check it out, or visit the peoples in an area and, mm-hmm. and what they're like. So for me, it was an opportunity to explore my region.
And so I'm curious about these 5 years before you even knew you had a contract or a book deal. Did you at any point in those 5 years, Bill, you know, ask yourself, what am I doing?
Probably the first day. Because
so what do you do? I mean, like at that point when you've got this vision and, you know, again, hindsight's 20/20, but first day, right. And then a year later and 2 years later and 3 and 4 years later, how did you keep the motivation to keep going and see this through?
You know what? Maybe that gives you a little bit of an idea about my personality. You know, if I make a commitment, I have to stick to it. You know, it was just something that, you know, I don't think I ever really doubted that I wasn't going to do the whole thing. You know, even I'll never forget my dad when he saw the exhibit and all the paintings, you know, because when you put them all together, the 115 paintings, it's really impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody asked him, they said, well, what do you think about all this? And my dad said, you know, he said, you know, you just don't know what some people have in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was great. I took him by surprise with being that determined. You know, that's just when I become determined about something, it's hard for me to let go.
I think that's that Irish background.
Right.
It's the stubborn fighting Irish. I've been accused of that myself. It's like a dog with a bone. You're not taking it out.
That's funny.
But I mean, I think that's something that's really, you know, interesting is, I mean, that's one thing, especially today, you know, because we're so used to instant, we're getting so spoiled and used to instant gratification that the idea of working, you know, like I get it, but you know, like sometimes when you're working on something for that long, for five years before, and I'm sure it was much longer afterwards, but for 5 years, you know, you didn't know if it was going to work out.
Yes. Yes. No, you're exactly right. It's something that's very hard to do. I'll be the first to admit it, but you know, somehow you just keep doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you share a story of a time in your journey when you encountered a big setback or experienced some sort of a failure, but more importantly, how did you deal with that?
Oh my gosh. Let's see. I've had so many. I don't know where to start, but it's you know, going out to California and being part of that whole plein air scene out in California. And then I've done these plein air events for 20 years, and I probably did sometimes as many as 8 a year, you know, not every year, but as many as that.
Wow.
And You know, and then it just kind of hit me that, you know, I asked myself the question. I said, if I do another plein air event, is it going to help my career? And that's because I've enjoyed doing them so much that I just asked that question, and I realized that when I really kind of searched deep inside, what I really wanted to do is to learn more about me and search more in my work and experiment more and find out more about who I am. Because many times you go to these events and you just run around and you paint and you work like a madman. And I just decided that I was just going to step off that bus for a while or, you know, just look at my work and just work. I just want to be more Billy O and not be known as a plein air event artist, you know, that goes, you know, because I just feel like I'm at that point where it's just not going to help my career. You know, I've won a lot of the big awards, and it's just time for me to move on. And me moving on will hopefully open up some areas for other artists coming up that need to be doing something like this or want to be doing it more.
So when you're saying that that's something that, I mean, that's very generous of you to open up the space for upcoming artists. Like, I love that you're often thinking of other artists and what you're contributing to the art world.
I shouldn't say like, I mean, I stopped doing them because I didn't think they were really doing a whole lot for my career. And I started looking for a new door. And of course, the one door that's opened up is that I'm being asked to judge a lot more, many more shows now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and philosophically for me, and philosophy comes into art all the time. Mm-hmm. When you start thinking about art, it's really all about the philosophy. If you're just painting and you got a formula, then you're not really getting into the philosophy. But then I should correct myself that oftentimes the philosophy does come about with a formula. So it's one of those things where I have not entered a painting competition in about 15 years, because I just didn't think it was philosophically right to have someone decide what the best piece was. But then if somebody asked me to judge a show, it was no problem for me to go in and say, well, this is the better piece, and this is the better piece, and this one. So when I closed that door on the plein air events, I started getting asked more and more to judge shows, which has been really exciting, because as a good judge, you have to study each piece. You have to look at each piece and think about each piece. You just can't look at a piece and say, oh, okay, and just move on. Mm-hmm. You just really have to study each piece, and you have to understand what it is the artist is trying to say. Mm-hmm. Because if you just use the fundamentals, the rules, you know, I was just recently looking at some of Cézanne's work, and Cézanne would use this technique sometimes where he put like these dark areas. He'd almost get black, but he'd get dark in like one area in the foreground and dark in another area in the midground, and then dark way in the distance and some spots. And it just hit me. I realized that he did that so that your eye would move to those areas. There's a device to move your eye around, you know. And you look at someone like Bernard. So, I mean, just an amazing colorist. But the way you look at some of his paintings and you realize that he understood perspective, he understood how things moved, but he also understood that if he flattened things out, it created a more interesting subject. So there's a lot of things artists do that, and they do it on purpose to just make you look at the piece in a different way. And that's where you come in with the creativity and the expression, and you have to try to factor that in. And how you factor it in just depends on the individual.
So when you're judging a painting contest, what are you looking for? So you're looking for that artist, you're trying to figure out what that artist's vision is, and then What are some of the other, I'm trying not to lead you into answers, so I'm not going to say and then this and that. But then what are some of the other things that you're looking for?
I tell everybody, I mean, I tell them exactly what I do. And what I do is I'll look at the paintings, usually between 10 and 15 10 and 15 feet away. And I look at the paintings and I see how well they carry. Mm-hmm. And then I look at them probably fairly close, like about 5 feet away. And I'll look at those paintings. And, you know, oftentimes at 10, 15 feet, there's a lot of paintings that don't carry. They do not carry very well. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, this last show I judged, there was a painting that just carried across the room. It was just, and it just really took my breath away in the way that the simplified forms just work so well. And, but then, you know, that it just really moved me. But then I get up real close and I look at each painting very, very closely just to see how the artist handles paint. Mm-hmm. You know, and because there's a lot of information in the variety of brush strokes, the structure of the strokes. You know, can they do a stroke that says nothing? Can they do a stroke that defines the plane? Can they, you know, so you ask a lot of questions like that. And again, you've got to think about what the painting is about. Oftentimes I walk through a museum, you know, I'm going to give you a little background on this. When I got out of college, the one thing I realized was that I lacked in visual knowledge of paint. And for about 5 years, I intensely traveled around the country. I drew a circle around St. Louis, about 750 miles out. And I actively, almost every weekend, went to shows across the country because Washington, D.C. is only like about 12 hours away. You know, you can go to Dallas, Fort Worth, which is probably only about 11 or 10. Denver is right at 12 and a half. You know, and so you start to have these amazing shows. And when I was getting out of college in the 1980s, that was, a lot of people haven't ever talked about this, but that era from the 80s to like the late 90s was the golden era of exhibitions. They put together exhibitions that were just phenomenal. And it gave, the art world came to me in the Midwest here. I mean, whenever they did a show, it usually went from California to the Midwest to the East Coast. Mm-hmm. Many of these paintings that have been in these exhibitions will probably rarely ever travel again because they've become so fragile. And it's that air was just an amazing time to go and see exhibits. And I would, you know, there were times when I'd go out to California, I'd go up to New York, and I'd see exhibitions, and many of the exhibits I went to in California, I'll never forget. John, I was telling John Stern about some of the exhibits I went and saw in California. He'd say, "Do you still have the catalog from that exhibit?" And he would say, "Well, those catalogs now, that catalog sells for about $600, you know, and you know, there would just be these little catalogs you'd pick up for $25 or something like that." Mm-hmm. But it was. So I, not only did I go to these shows, but I would always try to see these exhibits twice. And I'd want to be taken in by the artists and moved by the artists in a spiritual way, just to be in front of their work. And I enjoyed that. And then the second time I'd go through the exhibit, I would just pick the paintings apart and just analyze them and try to learn. And I'd go home and I'd emulate these things. So when I look at paintings today, and I go through there, I feel, and you could get closer to paintings back in the 80s and 90s. You can't get as close to them now, you know. And
mm-hmm. They get upset if you stick your nose up to them.
Yes, and you know, so it's that was just an amazing time, and I think that time has come and gone. And but that's not to say that I do a lecture oftentimes. Why this is the greatest time in the history of the art world to be an artist, because there's never been a time like this.
Right now.
Exactly. I did this talk way back in the late 90s. But there, you know, when you think back to Rubens, when he got so excited about Caravaggio's work that he probably, if I remember correctly, I read it somewhere and I can't find it again, but he spent months, you know, like in a stagecoach or horseback or however he had to travel to see about 15 of Caravaggio's paintings. Mm-hmm. Because no one really said, I've got one. You know, it was never listed anywhere. But we could hop on a plane in a weekend and we could fly to Rome. The Borghese Gallery has probably 15, you know, and there's that are accessible in Rome that you can see. We could see more than Rubens saw in like about 5-6 months time. And not only that, but we could pick up a book that tells you all about the artist's life, the artist's experience. We can read about the methods, the techniques, the materials he used. I mean, everything is there. And back then it was just a mystery. No one understood. They had to guess. You know, so it's, I mean, we have so much available to
us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now I get real excited about it. And
yeah, it's amazing how much access we have when you think about it. And even just the ability, you know, like you were saying, you get excited about your contemporaries and you're more inspired by them. But just the ability, like right now, to have this conversation, to reach out to somebody and say, like, hey, you know, let's talk about your art.
Exactly. And what you're doing is just an amazing experience for anyone to take advantage of. I mean, it's right there, you know, and they didn't have things like this years ago, you know. You know, and the same thing with museums. You know, when you look at the whole start of museums and then you look at what happened after World War II in the 70s, in the early 70s, they had over 350 million people visit art museums. And that was the start of the whole museum craze. And probably since the early 70s, there has been probably about 15,000 museums built here in America, and the same amount in Europe. And we have so many different kinds of interpretations of what art is today. We just have so much available to us. Not only that, but each of these museums have their own curators, their own writers, their restoration people. So we've got, and I'm not saying that there's been that many art museums. There's only about 1,500 art museums here in America, a little bit over 1,500, and same thing in Europe, because of the rest are other kinds of museums. But that's just amazing when you think about it. You think about that many museums.
Right, in a single country. How do you see the art market changing in the next, you know, like 5 to 10 years with all the access that you're talking about?
Well, the art market is changing, and you know, and of course, as painters, that's the one thing we're always doing is we're sitting around saying, "How can I sell this painting?" You know, mm-hmm. What do I do? Do I take it to the gallery? What do I do? Well, the market, I think there's some creative destruction going on, and mm-hmm. when I say creative destruction, that, you know, I would love to get into a gallery in California, but I just can't seem to find the right gallery in California. And there's a lot of these galleries where the rent has gone up so much that many of these galleries are closing because the rent has just increased so much. So the rent has gone up on a lot of these galleries recently, and a lot of these galleries have closed their doors. And so it creates a little bit of a tougher market, and that's where you maybe hope to rely on social media. So the other thing about, you know, social media is that, you know, people can only sit in front of the computer so long, you know. And so it's one of those things where you're just not sure where it's all going. I mean, it's definitely going – when you look at Europe and you look at what some of the artists have been doing in Europe in terms of marketing – they are selling more and more art online. It's actually getting to quite an impressive amount of money when you look at the amounts, the statistics that are documented. And I think the online and the social media are going to continue to grow, but I still think the galleries are going to hang on for a while. A lot of people are saying it's the end of the galleries. I think there's a real importance to the gallery, and I think there's also going to be maybe a, another option kind of popping up down the road. And that option is going to be, I think you're going to start to see collectors basically hiring artists to help them with their collections, to help advise them.
Oh, interesting. Why do you think that?
Because I think it's, I think the artists are there, and I think there's a tremendous amount of knowledge to tap into. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look back at, I think it was one of the Ashcan artists, I think it was Luke's. I might have that wrong. It might be another one. But anyway, he was advising like a very wealthy man on which artist to purchase, the Impressionists and things like that. So it's, I got a feeling you're gonna see more of that kind of thing. And the other thing that's going on is the universities are, you know, they're no longer hiring tenured artists. And, you know, they're not really hiring the artists.
The full-time professors, you mean?
Exactly. They're mm-hmm. they're hiring adjuncts. And, you know, I know some adjuncts here in St. Louis that, you know, they're having a tough time financially. And, yeah. and you know, they're maybe collecting food stamps on the side. It's just a tough thing. And so when universities...
It's kind of like the corporate world switching to contractors. It's just
yes,
easier.
Yes. But what happens is when they're only using, when you look at the statistics of these universities only using maybe one student's enrollment fee to pay the teacher,
mm-hmm.
1.5 times that.
Yeah, where's the money going?
Exactly. So all that money's going out. So what that's going to do, it's going to create an opportunity for people like me to teach. And that's kind of what, that's another project I've been working on for a while, is looking at ways that I could tap into this, because there's going to be a time, I think, with this, with the art market right now, with these galleries closing, with people switching over to social media and trying to make a living off social media, where a lot of people are going to turn to teaching. And I think that's going to be the whole big thing, I think, for the next few years with artists is teaching.
If you if you were starting out now, like, you know, like, let's say you just remove the Billio name.
Right.
And,
okay.
You know, like, all of a sudden you are, boom, you have to kind of recreate or create your career right now. What would you do?
That's simple. I would go to street shows. I'd go to art fairs. That's the easiest thing, because, you know, you set up and you've got a market coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You got people walking through and looking, and that's easy. I mean, I think the art festivals are going to become bigger and bigger. And and usually with a lot of these art fairs, almost anybody can get into them, but down the road, just watch. It's going to become tougher and tougher to get into more of these art fairs, because because as that market gets a little tight between the development of social media and people purchasing online and galleries, mm-hmm. I think the festivals are going to become a little bit more of the route. And, you know, if you can set your stuff up and you have 20,000 people walk through in a day,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you can't beat that. And I've got friends here in St. Louis that are doing that, and they're doing well.
Nice. Yeah, I know people who like, that's an enormous source of their income, is that and even the farmer's market.
Oh, wow.
You know, setting something up there on a weekly basis.
Yeah, the farmer's market, I know, out in California is a big thing. I mean, we've got little ones here in Missouri, because we have just so much farmland.
Yeah. And the weather here kind of allows it to go year-round.
That's true. I didn't think about that. That's right.
Can you describe a single habit that you strongly believe contributes to your success as an artist?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yeah, I'll give you one. Every year I try to burn about 50 paintings.
I love it.
Because they're just bad paintings. But, you know, what's interesting is when I burn them, sometimes the fire fixes them. I mean, it does these where it burns an area and the paint bubbles up and it, and sometimes these paintings, and I've pulled some of them from the fire and
really?
Kept them. Yeah, just there. I imagine someday somebody will find a stack of those and say, what are these burnt up things for? But when you have some teachers in your past, that some of the best teachers you can have are teachers that have a respect and appreciation for creativity in all its forms. Mm-hmm. And that's where the artist really resides, is always keeping open. There's been times that I've had a painting fall face down in the grass and I pull it up and it's fixed. Mm-hmm. And you look at it with this perplexity and say, what just happened? You know, why does this work? So there are times when accidents happen or things happen and you just really wonder. But I think that's a good habit. I think, but lately I haven't been burning them. Since I've been painting a lot thicker, I've been just pushing the paint a lot thicker. I've actually been saving a lot of those panels now. So I haven't burned anything in this last year. I've been painting on top of other paintings, which makes me paint even thicker, you know, so.
But this idea of curating your work and.
I really think it's the idea of looking at a painting and saying, do I really want that painting getting out there and someone saying, Billy O did this?
Right.
You know, so I think that is the motivator. And then there's times when I've looked at pictures of paintings that I've burnt and destroyed, and I'd look at it and I'd say, as you age, your eye changes. And I look at it and I go, well, you know what? That wasn't so bad. It's like, but there was something there that bothered me a while back.
But you took the lesson with you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Very nice.
It's always fun. You never know what's going to happen sometimes in the studio each day or out on location.
That's what makes it fun.
Yes, yes. And I think I've answered some of your questions. Some of them I may not have answered directly, but I apologize for that if I didn't. I got lost in the story.
No, that's okay. I was just before we wrap it up, the one question you didn't answer was about your setbacks.
And where I was going with that was I've been to all these events and stuff, and I painted in plein air for a long time. And, you know, it was one of those things where there's a really prestigious group out there called the Plein Air Painters of America. Mm-hmm. It just never really happened for me. I was never invited as a guest. You've got to be invited a couple of years in a row to be a guest. And it just never happened. And it just kind of, you know, and I've known a lot of these artists for a long time. And then sure enough, just in the last couple of years of my life, I got invited and I got voted in as a member. So it would have been nice if that would have happened a long time ago. You know, it's one of those things where it just didn't happen for a long time. And maybe my work wasn't ready for it at that time. I don't, you know.
What did you take away from that?
You know, it's one of those things where I have thought about it a little bit. And when I was a guest, I was having these dreams about thick paint. And I was having these dreams where I was putting my hands in buckets of color and just smearing it on the canvas. And then I would have these dreams where I'd have this giant paintbrush that was so heavy would be on bungee cords, and I would be dipping it in the paint and swinging it around. And, you know, and I just remember in the dreams I'd be out of breath from, you know, just doing this stuff. And I'd play a little game of myself. Whenever I did a plein air event and I usually had to fly home, the paint would dry. So I'd do this little game of myself where I would go out and do my last painting, and I would try to do a painting where I use all the paint on my palette. Uh-huh. And that painting would take on, it became a creative problem and would take on such a unique feel that it was really fun for me. And sometimes I would sell those paintings. Mm-hmm. And so my work started changing. I started painting really thick. And that's when I went up as a guest, when I was painting really thick, had been painting thick for a while. And that's when I got into the Plein Air Painters of America. So sometimes, you know, maybe my work just wasn't ready. Maybe I just had to.
You needed to experiment a little bit more, find.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But the journey got me there.
Yeah. You know?
So in a way I hope I kind of answered your question. I just wasn't immediately accepted into that group, and it was something that took time.
Mm-hmm. But it allowed you to experiment, or you found that by experimenting and letting loose, that's actually how you ended up getting in a way.
So, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and at the same time, my father passed away, and my father was a sergeant in the Marines, you know, and he he was one that was not real excited about my choice of becoming an artist. My mother was always supportive. You know, my dad was supportive later in life. Like, he was really just impressed with everything. But it was one of those things that just kind of carried over from, and when he passed away, it just, you know, I just kind of got deeper into the work. You know, just, I just kind of melted into the paint and became a paint.
Billy-O, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Fun. You really pulled some things out of me.
Good.
thank you. Thank you very much. Keep painting.
Yes, absolutely.
Got some wonderful artists out there to inspire you, so keep painting. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much to Billy-O for sharing so much of himself and his journey. You can go to savvypainter.com to see his thick, juicy paintings and for links to some of the artists that he mentioned. And while you are there, pick up a special cheat sheet from this episode, How to Critique Your Own Painting. This is a compilation of questions you can use today to improve your painting. I want to give a big thank you to Gyla Irwin, Karen O'Connell, Kathy Naus, Red Ochre Press, Jeanette Gray Art, Deborah Shapiro, Denise Klitzy, Patricia Matrenga, Barbara Chantre, Greg Decker, Christine Rasmussen, Arun Littlejohn, and Jiyoung Kim Studio. Thank you so much for your support of the podcast. Until the next time, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.